Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University College of Arts and Sciences African American Studies Program. Speaking will be Mark Auslander, Director of the Master's Program in Cultural Production and Professor of Anthropology at Brandeis University. Professor Auslander's lecture is titled, Welcome Back to Life, Regeneration and Traumatic Memory in a Multiracial Lynching Reenactment. We begin with an introduction by Professor Linda Haywood, Director of the African American Studies Program.
Today, I have the distinct pleasure of welcoming Dr. Mark Auslander, is the Director of the Interdisciplinary Master's Program in Cultural Production and an Assistant Professor in the Department of Anthropology at Brandeis University. He is a sociocultural anthropologist with strong interests in political and symbolic processes in Africa and the African diaspora. His principal ethnographic research has been in Eastern Zambian Ngoni communities and among African-American families in rural Georgia. He received his undergraduate and graduate training in anthropology at the University of Chicago. His academic writings explore a wide range of topics, including South Central African witch-finding movements, popular contests over South African nature reserves, and the social meaning of lynching photography, popular narratives of slavery in the rural American South, and African-American cemeteries and family reunions. He has consulted at the Smithsonian on the African Voices exhibition project and worked on Without Sanctuary, Lynching Photography in America at the Martin Luther King Jr. Historic Site in Atlanta. Today, Dr. Auslander's lecture is entitled, We Come Back to Life, Regeneration and Traumatic Memory in a Multiracial Lynching Reenactment. It is my pleasure again to welcome a friend, colleague, and someone whose work I really admire. He's a very interesting, he has a very interesting approaches to the study of human life, especially African and African American, Dr. Mark Auslander.
Thank you, Linda. It's wonderful to be here at African American Studies today. In James Joyce's Ulysses, Stephen Dedalus famously remarks, "History is a nightmare from which I am trying to awake." In this paper, I'd like to explore how a multiracial group of men and women in the American South have intentionally reentered the terrain of a collectively reproduced historical nightmare, a nightmare from which they have attempted, with varying degrees of success, to awake. For the past 4 years, these African American and white activists have publicly reenacted one of the most notorious lynchings in American history. On the evening of July 25th, 1946, four young African Americans were murdered at the Moores Ford Bridge on the border between Waltham and Oconee counties in north central Georgia. The killings, often referred to as the last public mass lynching in American history, remain officially unsolved. None of the estimated 12 to 15 white supremacist perpetrators believed to have been involved have ever been indicted or prosecuted in the case. Two commentaries by participants frame my exploration of these events. The first was uttered by a woman I'll call Rachel, as she prepared to lay down on the muddy riverbank of the Appalachian River on the early evening of July 25th, 2005, about 4.5 years ago. She was participating in the first reenactment of this notorious lynching, held on its 59th anniversary by a group of African-American community activists. At that point, no white collaborators were participating. A white friend had asked her, though, why was she taking part in this unbearably painful event? "You can't know what's inside of me," Rachel responded. "You can't know what I carry right here inside of me all of my days. There's something inside of me that makes me do this." The second comment was uttered last summer by a man I'll call Richard at the conclusion of the 2008 reenactment. He, too, had been lying on the ground of the riverbank, having played George Dorsey, one of the murdered lynching victims. As he stood up amidst the excitement and congratulations among the reenactors and the supporters, he said, "We come back to life. We come back to life." And thus the talk of my presentation. I seek to understand why the reenactment was performed initially in 2005 and why it has become an annual event every year since. Why has the reenactment taken such a hold on the imaginations of those who participated in it? And why, among erstwhile political allies, it has occasioned such bitter controversies and disputations? What kinds of collective and individual dreamscapes on the inside and on the outside are constituted and negotiated through this complex performance? And in what ways, paradoxically, does this event allow its participants, who come into such intimate contact with horror and tragedy, to, in their own words, come back to life? It's not really possible to read, as we'll see, this event as a fixed text. Perceptions and experience of the reenactment vary dramatically, even among those who are closely allied politically and who are intimately involved in its staging and performance. Many people in the community passionately favor it, others deeply oppose it, others are torn in two, they say, over it. Many even claim, many of the participants, especially the white participants, claim they can't actually remember what goes on within it, that they enter into a kind of fugue state and cannot recall performing the roles of the Klansmen. Others say that this plunges them into deep nightmares, an uncanny sense of hauntedness, as if untamable demons have been released. And matters are complicated still more by the fact that much of this is mediated through television, through cable news, through YouTube, and so forth. They're complex struggles over sexuality, race, and kinship in this performance arena, as you might expect. I'm particularly interested, curiously enough, in the status of a small doll, representing an African-American child that is believed by some members of the local community to have been horrifically cut out of the uterus of one of the lynching victims. There's so much passionate debate over this particular figurine, this small doll, every year. And in understanding that debate, we'll get maybe perhaps a better sense of why there's such bitter struggles, what's at stake in this particular enactment. Now, before getting into these dreams and nightmares and the dolls associated with the reenactment, I'll just review a little bit of the historical background. As some of you know, the summer of 1946 saw extensive incidents of racial violence across the Deep South, much of it directed against African-American servicemen and associated with struggles over access to the franchise. White perpetrated racial violence was especially intense in the state of Georgia, as a bitter gubernatorial election battle revolved around the question of the Supreme Court's decision, that's Smith v. Allwright, authorizing black participation in the Democratic state primary process. During that summer, at least four separate lynchings took place in Georgia. As some of you know, the only African-American brave enough to try to vote in his district was shot to death. Of these racial killings, the most notorious was this mass murder at Moore's Ford. That's about 60 miles northeast of Atlanta. The location was partially, in a sense, overdetermined. Walton County was Georgia's leading cotton-producing county. Its contoured landscape had kept out mechanical pickers, and there was direct white control over black labor that was highly imperiled, and it was in that context that intensive racial violence became, in a sense, a norm during this, in the whole mid-20th century period. So although the struggle over the vote and the local political ecology frame these killings, the precise details of the lynchings illustrate the complex webs of kinship and sexuality, of affiliation, opposition, resistance, and complicity that characterize the racial micropolitics of the Jim Crow South. The background is this. On July 14, 1946, Roger Malcolm, who was an African-American sharecropper, and his employer, a white farmer named Barney Hester, had a violent altercation. Malcolm suspected his white employer of having an affair with his girlfriend, sometimes referred as his common-law wife, who, like Roger, had been working in the white farmer's family. Hester, some reported, had been attempting to whip Malcolm for beating Dorothy. Malcolm, at some point, stabbed the white farmer with a knife. He then fled. He was apprehended by local whites. Hester, the farmer, actually recovered from his wounds, but at the time it was thought that he was going to die, and it was in that context that that Malcolm was taken to prison, taken to the local county lockup, and there was enormous speculation that the Klan would, in fact, kill him at some point. What happened on July 25th was complex and is still debated a little bit. But Loy Harrison, who was a local white farmer, who in fact employed Malcolm's girlfriend's brother, bailed Malcolm out of jail, explaining he'd come back where he could work to pay off the bail money. That was a standard procedure, of course, in the area, employing coerced black laborers in this essentially penal-related system, which was to some extent, as you know, a structural continuation of plantation slavery. Also in the vehicle was Dorothy Dorsey Malcolm, who was, and then also Dorothy's brother George Dorsey, and George's girlfriend May Murray, George Dorsey was a U.S. Army veteran recently returned from service in the Pacific. Now, Harrison, the white farmer, drove his car on a circuitous route, and all these details have become very important in the reenactment, bringing it eventually to the isolated bridge over the Appalachian River at Moore's Ford. It's significantly on the border of two counties, Walton and Oconee. And there the vehicle was stopped by 12 to 15 armed white men who violently removed the four young African-Americans from the car and hung a noose around Roger Malcolm's neck. Within minutes, all four African-Americans had been dragged down the embankment. They were dead, their bodies pierced by scores of bullet holes. Now, there's some evidence that the murderers may only have anticipated killing Roger Malcolm, but then when one of the African-American women recognized the ringleader, the white ringleader by name, the Klansmen decided to kill all four of them. There are many debates about this. Now, one of these many debates is the question of whether or not Dorothy Malcolm, the common law wife of Roger Malcolm, was in fact pregnant at the time. But it is widely believed in the African-American community that a Klansman cut from her fetus out of her uterus after shooting her. Now, the case did attract national attention, first in the black press and then in the national mainstream white media. A large reward was offered. These are the four victims here. And you can get a sense of how everybody's related. There was a horrific aftermath for the family itself. Roger, the namesake child, was in fact taken by his mother to Ohio because it was thought the Klan was going to kill him. There's a long, complex story that we'll get into later about the devastating consequences for the surviving family, for the surviving families. President Harry Truman was so disturbed that a returning serviceman had been killed that he actually ordered an extensive FBI investigation. He later asserted that the murder was the final factor leading in his order to desegregate the U.S. Armed Forces. But it's quite clear that a local conspiracy of silence and terror was launched. There's considerable evidence of involvement by senior law enforcement in the county. No eyewitnesses came forward. No suspects were ever publicly identified, although there's strong consensus to this day in the African-American community as to the identities of many of the perpetrators. In a sense, this killing, it's important to understand, typified a historical shift away from spectacle lynchings, which had been held in full public view in the late 19th and early 20th century and frequently photographed, towards what we might call underground lynchings, especially in the mid-20th century, in which the conspirators could generally be assured that witnesses would be too intimidated to come forward. The case sent, of course, enormous shockwaves through the local African-American community. It remains an enormous source of trouble and anxiety to this day. In 1991, the case really re-entered public consciousness when a white man came forward claiming to have been a child in the Grove and to have witnessed the precise circumstances of the killing. And this led to the formation of a very interesting multiracial group of concerned citizens who attempted to retell the story, to document it, establish restitution in some ways, college scholarships for at-risk African-American youth in the county. It's been a very fascinating process. My students and I, when I taught at Emory University, were heavily involved in this process of locating and documenting the location of the graves of the victims, helping to place crosses and so forth. There's been a lot of memorial and monumental work here, as there have been in several dozen other communities across the country in which multiracial groups have come together to face up to the legacies of lynching. And many important artists have been involved in these projects as well. I'm delighted to see in our audience today that Keith Washington, who's done a very important artistic project documenting sites of lynching, is here with us today. And there are many others that have been involved in comparable work. But the reenactment was a very fascinating idea. Apparently, it first came to Charles Steele, then an Alabama state senator who had been, who at that point had just been become the president of the Southern Christian Leadership, the national president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And as he was taking a memorial walk actually across the bridge, he was seized by this idea that there should be a reenactment. A number of local activists, like this one activist put it, you know, white folks love their Civil War reenactments. That's just one big fantasy about the lost cause being so noble. So why not reenact some real history for a change? Tyrone Brooks, a prominent SCL activist who's a Georgia state senator, got heavily involved in this through his organization, the Georgia Association of Black Elected Officials, got others involved. And rather rapidly, this was pulled together. And it got a lot of press coverage, unexpectedly. New York Times gave it prominent coverage. CNN gave it some coverage. In addition to the events at the bridge, the day really followed the entire event. There was a kind of almost a sense of moving across the Stations of the Cross, beginning at the farm, the Hester farm, where the initial knife fight had taken place. That was reenacted. The bailing out at the jail was reenacted. The drive that brought the victims to their site of their death was actually reenacted. And so the whole group, a whole large group was following this. It was a kind of progress, a procession, moving in a sense back in time across the landscape. There was an interest in precise historical verisimilitude, in contrast to, for example, Civil War reenactors, who really are careful, of course, to wear uniforms. Reenactors were wearing shorts, dresses that were that are present day. Actual guns were used, though, in the first reenactment. What people emphasized, so many of my friends who have worked on this have emphasized, is their desire to be authentic in terms of the actual feelings and emotions that were felt, but that they didn't care so much about the particular props. And that's been true really for the past 4 years. It is, in a sense, an effort by all of these different members of the community to work things out. So many people talk about this. We need to understand, what was it like to be a perpetrator? That's what many of the African-American men who played Klansmen the first time said. We needed to know what they felt, how they could do this thing, how they could justify it to themselves and their loved ones. And similarly, many of those that play the victims have emphasized, we needed to know what they went through. It's our only way to being close to them. And we don't need the props to get there. We don't need a car that looks exactly like a 1946 car. Now, they did get worried, especially under pressure from mass media, that this needed to be a slicker production. It needed to be better dramatically produced. They reached out, in fact, to a local overwhelmingly white peace organization in Atlanta that had been very involved in anti-Iraq war activity. And they had theatrical background. And in a sense, they wanted some street credibility working with an African-American community organization. So in a sense, both interests were served. And they began to collaborate. It's been a very difficult collaboration in which white peace activists, some of them right from this community, but most of them from Atlanta, come out, dress themselves up as Klansmen, not only men. It's been hard to get many white men in the area to play up being Klansmen. Many of them are women peace activists who dress themselves up as Klansmen and actually quite skillfully play white Klansmen at this. Every year, something unexpected happens. The second year, an African-American woman in the crowd, who I'll call Maria, was so deeply disturbed over the sight of four African-American bodies just laying there, left at the end. There was no closing prayer or anything like that, that she began to sing a hymn. And she then got sort of recruited officially the next year. The organizers dressed her up as a white angel. She didn't like that much. This last summer she came back just wearing a black dress, explaining, "I'm just an ordinary person. I'm just doing what a regular church lady would do. I'm simply paying honor to those we have lost." But there's a constant struggles over how to stage this. In 2007, this became the lead story on CNN International in a 24-hour news cycle. Wasn't featured as prominently in the United States, although it was seen by many people. So this has reached, what everyone thinks of it, an enormously wide audience worldwide. Many of my friends all over Africa have corresponded to me, having seen this and so forth. In a sense, it has higher visibility than it does in many parts of the United States. It's very hard often for many members of the crowd who aren't in the press to see it, although they can hear the screams, which are absolutely blood-curdling. Each year there's something new. Year before last, a reenactor played Governor Talmadge, who on the eve of the lynching may well have at least given tacit permission or encouragement during the campaign for the killing to take place. And then the shootings take place, and there's usually firecrackers in the background and so forth. And then everybody crowds around, as you can see. The organizers have bullhorns, have megaphones, and narrate what's happened, but people just come around. And this, I suppose, as someone who has worked extensively on lynching photography, is I suppose, particularly disturbing. There's so many troubling and difficult aspects of this phenomena. But to see so many people, including so many white news photographers, but not only white, but photographing the mimetic, the reenacted bodies of African Americans having been killed, is, of course, deeply reminiscent of a very long history of the photographic framing of the lynch bodies of African American men and women. The so-called money shot of the 2006 and 2007 reenactments was the staged cutting out of the abdomen of the actress who plays Dorothy Murray Malcolm of the seven-month-old fetus. This is triumphantly held up by the Klansmen. And in the audience in 2007, I could hear one person saying, "White man, the devil." Another man said, "Worse than the devil." It's a very potent moment. Very deeply disturbing, as you can imagine, to the right reenactors, many of whom are feminist activists, are deeply committed to a narrative of multiracial justice, to be sure, but also of reconciliation. So there's a big struggle about this. And then this past year, there was a sort of attempt to work out an agreement. I think for many of the white reenactors, although they were strong supporters of the reenactment, this one act was particularly troubling. To their minds, so many of them emphasized, it's as if the deaths of the adults weren't enough to simply go after the fetus and claim that was the great crime. Somehow implies that there wasn't full humanity. I mean, this has gotten deeply caught up in struggles over abortion in Georgia, and also they're very complicated struggles in the shadow of Proposition 8. Many of the white women activists are gay and have been engaged in very complex conversations with their allies in the local African American community over issues of homophobia, rights to gay marriage, and so forth. So this becomes a vast, complex text in which almost every major issue in American society and culture gets caught up with. Rehearsals, as you can imagine, are extremely fraught because what's happening is these are not trained actors. There's not a script. Each year, a group gets together and tries to really work out among themselves what must have happened. So you have this very strange scenes during rehearsals in which white progressives are playing the roles of Klansmen, are screaming at the top of their voices racial epithets, the M-word a lot, and many scatological terms and so forth, and taking two African-American men and two African-American women and throwing them down on the ground, practicing holding guns to their heads, threatening to kill them. There's a certain amount of joking around during this sort of in-between moments to relieve some of the tension, but it's very difficult. The first year, African-American participants had a lot of trouble making a noose. And one of the things they've noted is that one thing about having white folks back, you know, helping us out, is the guys seem to be awfully good at making nooses. And there's a certain amount of commentary about that. In 2008, the man who actually made a noose very, very skillfully was at great pains to explain to me after the reenactment that he'd actually not learned to make the noose where I thought he'd learned to make the noose, but actually it was at Jewish day camp, and in fact he's a distant cousin of Leo Frank and so forth. So there's a lot of sort of repositioning at this. At the end of this last summer's rehearsal, Gina, a young black woman who had been playing Mae Murray, joked to everybody as she was leaving, having been thrown down on the ground and having the N-word screamed into her face for many hours of rehearsal, sort of joked, "I just want to say you all are the bestest white supremacists I've ever had the pleasure of working with." And, you know, it was a joke, but there was a certain edge to it, of course. Well, it's important to understand, as we sort of try to make sense of this whole event, and by the way, there was one African-American pastor who was present, not officially involved, but who came and uttered a long and very beautiful prayer, asking the Lord to let these souls rest in peace, to sanctify the ground. Because the actual organization of this really had no place, no ending for it. This is a great debate, of course, that has raged around the question of lynching photography, of lynching memorialization. Did the dead die without sanctuary? Are lynching victims, in the name of the photographic exhibition, truly without sanctuary? Because, of course, from a Christian perspective, no one dies without sanctuary. And this debate continues to rage around. Are the dead still there? Are they dying again in a latter day Calvary, is there a possibility of redemption? This is really an unsolved problem. And has torn apart, among other things, the Morse Ford Memorial Committee, which was the large multiracial organization that had been founded to commemorate the lynching, that emphatically does not endorse this particular ceremony. It's really run by the Georgia Association of Black Elected Officials. So why does it happen? Well, the manifest reason for the ceremony, it is said, is to wake up the white community. There has, of course, been no prosecution. The FBI has been pressured enormously. It has reopened the case recently. The recent federal passage of the Emmett Till bill does free up a certain amount of resources and person power in the FBI to investigate these kinds of cold case, long-running unsolved civil rights cases. But the activists in Georgia are very mindful that, in contrast to Alabama and Mississippi, where there have been successful cold case civil rights prosecutions, that hasn't happened close to home. And their hope, in many say, is that this reenactment will be like hitting people with a 2x4, forcing the country to wake up to its own history, forcing the county, and forcing witnesses to come forth with evidence that can actually lead to prosecution. This, of course, now we're 62 years past the murder. Most perpetrators probably are no longer alive. There are two or three who may well be walking the streets of Monroe, Georgia, who were directly involved. So chances of prosecution may be low, but the activists are committed. Anything we can do to raise the profile and pressure. Of course, there are all sorts of arguments. There are community members who are sort of estranged from the old guard, SCLC folks, who claim that they're trying to sort of grab the limelight to argue for their own relevance in the age of Obama. But there are other activists, especially those working on anti-poverty campaigns, that are troubled not so much by the reenactment, but by the fact that the organizers come in one day out of the year and then go back to Atlanta or fly back to Chicago and so forth. African-American community activist stated, "What are these reenactments actually doing for the low-income people of Walton County? That's what I want to know. They come in with their media caravan, they get themselves on CNN, but at the end of the day, we're still here. We're dealing with police brutality, environmental racism, crystal meth epidemic, and skyrocketing HIV rates. And they're long gone. They've boosted their reputations but done nothing at all for our community." There are, of course, others who argue that the problem is that interracial solidarity and reconciliation breaks down. They're countered by those that argue, what's the point of any kind of interracial reconciliation if there's no justice? Some, in fact, fear that shots will be fired. That hasn't happened yet, but especially at the reenactment of the knife fight, the reenactors do go out to a white community, which has the descendants of probably many of the perpetrators, and it gets very, very tense. There's a lot of screaming, a lot of racial epithets thrown back and forth. So what's fascinating about this is that there's no coherent agreement as to the meaning of these events, and yet so many people, many hundreds of people, are deeply committed to seeing them continued. And what's fascinating for me, I suppose, as someone who's worked a great deal on the symbolism of dreams in African communities and African American communities, is the emphasis on dreams. So many of those involved, either for or against this event, emphasize the importance of their own dreams. Take Timothy. Now, he's the white man that we saw very briefly coming across the bridge as the lead Klansman. Now, he was asked to play the lead Klansman. He was very reluctant. He actually said, he turned to me at that point and said, "Let me not drink from this cup," but he reluctantly consented. He's an experienced marksman and a hunter, and during the rehearsal, he found himself sort of skillfully explaining to many of the white peace activists who didn't know how to use firearms how they would go about convincingly shooting somebody. He'd actually grown up some miles away from this event. He believes it's quite possible that one of his uncles might have been involved. He feels a deep moral responsibility. But he and his sidekick, James, who were out on the bridge, really did enter into another state. When Ellen and I approached them, they were really quite hostile to us. They were moving the guns in some ominous ways. We moved back. Afterwards, they claimed not to remember that. In fact, Timothy said he remembered nothing of the event. He'd entered into a kind of fugue state. "It's a horrible thing to do, but I was not there. I'd say it's a fugue state. I think I'm still in a bit of shock. It's not somewhere you want to inhabit. doing this. And he explained that what plagued him in particular is the night before the reenactment, he'd had a very powerful nightmare. He'd been given an enormous writhing cobra and told to take care of it. And in the dream, the snake had actually struck him, sticking its fangs deep into his into his side, right here. It's precisely the position, of course, in Christian iconography, where Jesus is lanced by the Roman soldier. And he did. There's a very strong Christological sense. Many people feel they're caught up in the story of the crucifixion yet again, and don't know, as they say, how to find their way out of it. Now, Patricia is the not Roger Malcolm's biological daughter, but the daughter of Roger Malcolm's legal wife. She has been plagued by a series of horrific dreams and visions. She is probably the most forceful opponent of the reenactment. She believes that the waves of black and black violence, of growing heroin usage, crystal meth usage, and the incarceration of African American youth in the county, and the numbers are indeed very high, are precisely related to the persistence of the memories of the lynching and of the reenactment. She believes that there's a force, and other community members have told me this as well, that under that bridge there is an unquiet force of those who died under such horrific circumstances, for whom justice has never been done, still are out there frozen in a sort of tableau of hatred and anger and pain, and that they reach out, especially to the African-American youth of the county. And she stresses that the reenactment, she feels, feeds that beast, she says, as blood cries out for blood, violence cries out for violence. And she's asked again and again, is it not possible to stop this, to find a way off of the cycle? And she's actually raised the question that she feels that the only way that this terrible violence can be ended, and she's very worried about the condition of her own sons who have been themselves incarcerated multiple times, that she feels they carry this curse. And she's wondered, couldn't artists possibly come to the county and help us see things? Because artists help us see things that are beyond what we can see in our normal vision. And the African-American artist Kevin Sipp, who's Atlanta-based, has himself become very interested in this and has wondered if there might be some attempt by artists to come out and do a sort of healing ceremony for the land, because he works with many at-risk youth in Atlanta who are run with gangs, and many of them describe a persistent dream that again and again they are being chased at night and by a shadowy mob. And then they wake up just as they're about to die. And many of them explain this is the reason that they carry automatic weapons with them, that they run with gangs, in order that this won't happen to them. And he believes that they are, in fact, facing a predicament, that they have been inhabited or possessed by the spirits of the lynching victims, the victims of lynching, who have no place else to go. And so he dreams of a way of solving this collective nightmare through the erection of Congo-style inkisi, of holders of the spirit, of kind of works of art, of trees by the riverside that might give an alternate space. This hasn't happened yet, but he too is very worried about the problem of the reenactment. It's interesting that the state representative, Tyrone Brooks, who, of course, has been a very important civil rights activist in the community and who really has been leading this struggle to have the reenactments, himself has had a series of very powerful dreams before the 2008 reenactment. He reported a repeating dream in which he heard a voice, which he believed ultimately to come from the Lord, telling him that the unborn child, the fetus that's so debated, needed a name. And he heard a name. The name was Justice Malcolm. He repeated this story a great deal on print media and on the radio. He sermonized about it at First African Baptist Church in Monroe on the day of the reenactment. We now name this baby Justice, denied justice in death. He is accorded justice in the hereafter. There was an enormous fight. He hadn't cleared the name with the actual family members of the survivors. So there's a great deal of bitterness. This got into the Georgia media, lots of going back and forth. It's impossible to know, of course, what really happened in July of 1946 and whether or not there was a fetus cut out. What's fascinating, I suppose, in a sociological sense, is that so many people feel so strongly on both sides. This sort of thing certainly did happen. There's the very famous case of the mob killing of Mary Turner in Georgia some years earlier, in 1918. A white mob had not been able to find the person they wanted to kill. They killed Haynes Turner, who was a former employee of the victim. And his wife protested this, Mary Turner. She was 8 months pregnant when she protested the lynching. And as punishment for having protested it publicly, she was hung upside down by her ankles at a bridge, soaked with gasoline, burned to death. And it is well documented that the Klan did, in fact, that the killers did, in fact, cut her open and smash the skull of her fetus. So these horrible things did happen. Whether or not they happened in the specific case, it's impossible to know. But there's such great controversy over this. But what I'm struck really is by the many different stories and struggles over who has the right to speak for the dead in these events. So many people feel they need to talk for the dead, and so many others feel that one needs to defer that those statements. But the woman who we call Barbara, who carried the doll with her and who produced it even over the agreement that had existed among the activists, is herself a very fascinating and moving case, and it tells us something about the variegated motivations of people who participate in these kinds of events. She has a career in law enforcement. Her son Michael was murdered at age 26 in a drug-related shooting in Atlanta. The circumstances are not clear. But she's preserved everything from this horrific event, his blood-soaked shirt, his baby pictures, and so forth, and she's put them together in a frame, and she goes around to schools, to youth groups, especially working with at-risk African American and Latino youth throughout Georgia, talking to them about the dangers of violence, especially between youth of color, and asking that they find a way of strength within themselves to stand out of these cycles of violence. So she believes that the reenactment is a powerful way of struggling against these cycles of violence. And when she was told, I mean, she sort of sat through this long statement, really, by the white feminist activist about why the doll was inappropriate. And then that night went home and with a friend felt that she had to go out and actually make the doll herself with the friend because, as she said, they took my baby boy away from me once. They're not going to take this boy away from me. He needs to be remembered. So for her, the struggle to tell the story of a lost child becomes coterminous with the struggle to tell the story of her own son that was lost and of the many African-American young men who she feels so deeply imperiled at this moment. It gives you just a sense of the many ways that people find of participating in this ceremony. Well, we started with that phrase, history is a nightmare from which I am trying to awake. To what extent, then, have the participants and their close interlocutors awoken from the nightmare of this particular history and from this commemorative practice? I'm fascinated, you know, that evening, this past July 25th, that Richard, who's playing George Dorsey here on the right, said that line, "We come back to life now, we come back to life." And these words are really worth pondering because in a manifest sense, well, they just played at being dead and now they were alive again. But in a ritual sense, we might say, the performers had moved out of what anthropologists would call the liminal stage, that in-between stage in any ritual of transition, in which they were neither one thing or another. They were neither fully alive, neither fully dead. They've just been reintegrated back into the community of the living. So in that sense, we come back to life. But more than that, I do think, and this is a very fascinating, confusing thing, is that those that participate do feel re-enlivened by this. It's a terrifying and a horrible thing to go through, but there is a profound sense of solidarity and even excitement going through this, the reenactors' stress. Partly it's because their various subject positions have been sort of interpolated. People have experienced what it was like to be a murderer, what it was like to be a victim. And in that sense, they have participated in something that is extraordinary and many say actually transcendent. They've learned something deep, profound about what it is to be human, a recognition that none of us are without sin, that all of us carry a dimension of evil or a possibility of evil within themselves. So they're very striking possibilities, you know, for those of you in the audience who are medievalists, suggested parallels between this event and medieval passion plays in which ordinary people perform scenes from the gospel And some scholars have argued that the Passion plays, well, they were, of course, directly about a Christian narrative, especially about the trials and ultimately crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus, also incorporated a much older, even pagan, notion of cycles of loss and rebirth, that the last would be first and the first last, that some sort of regeneration happens. And there is a very powerful community-building dimension. Now, I wouldn't suggest that it's exactly like this. There's not a clear narrative of full redemption here, nor is there precisely a script. Different things happen each year. And one gets a sense of a kind of experimental consciousness here that that in a very difficult way, this multiracial group of performers, of activists, comes together to try to work something out. All of them feel there's something wrong in American society. We don't know quite what it is. It's about race, but it's about lots of other things, too. It's about the predicament of youth. It's about it's about drugs. It's about persistent deepening economic inequality. We have to work it out. There's something wrong in us. We have to find what it is, so many of them emphasize. And so that question of getting, quote, as Rachel says, what is inside of us? There's something inside of me. Finding out what that thing is. This is a process, in a sense, of actively trying to work things out. It's perhaps also a way, and this is perhaps especially true for many of the African-American male activists who are involved in this, who emphasize that terrible, terrible things have been done to black men for so long. This is a way of us doing something ourselves, of standing up, of saying, horrible things were done, we are going to tell this truth, and then we're going to march on so that we will have a future. And that whole theme of a future is very powerful for a lot of the performers, a lot of the activists. It's even, interestingly enough, a theme for Representative Brooks, who has that powerful dream, remember, that there's a son, that there's a boy that was born, that was to be born, that was not born, and that he will give him a name, and that that name will stand for all those who have died without memory, without name, that there's a kind of, if you like, symbolic male progeny that's being allowed to continue. And I think many of the women performers as well feel that the idea that the fetus would be excluded from this story is almost anathema to them, because we need to leave something behind, as one of the women said. This doll, it reminds us of the fact of so many who were taken from us. Often this relates to stories that go all the way back to the Middle Passage, to stories of relatives, of family members who should be here who are not. So that thought of a sort of lineage being cut off is enormously powerful. How does one understand that ethically? I'm not at all sure. The ironies do seem to be palpable. For generations, of course, this was the promise of lynching, that it would bring together a community in white America, that through the visibly tortured body of the black man, our own pollution would be expiated, and the body politic would be reborn anew, refreshed and purified. And it's well known that white boys throughout the South were actively made into white men, in part through lynching. Paging through old white Southern family photo albums, one comes across, towards the end of a section on manly sports, celebrating the boy's passage into adulthood, his first boxing match, his first deer shot, and then his first lynching. Today, a lynch mob, a leader famously intoned, "You have done the work of men." So lynching for so long was, in parts of the white community, about the process of making white masculinity. So is something like this going on, or is this, in fact, you know, is a kind of masculinity is being restored here? Is that entirely the undoing of the old narrative, or does the old narrative, in some disturbing ways, leave its echoes? It is fascinating, of course, though, that so much of this centers in on photography, and the history of racial violence in the United States for 150 years has been so tied in with the power of the photograph, with the power of the image, which is one of the reasons, of course, that artists have so struggled in so many ways to reclaim the very process of image making and framing of these deaths. For so long, like spectacle lynching, in some ways, this ritual process of death and the regeneration of life is accomplished through the miracle of photography. Scores of photographers crowd around the prone, bloodied bodies, securing the shadow in order to endlessly reproduce in print, on air, and online the images of those who can no longer reproduce themselves. In the beautiful essay about photography, Camera Lucida, Roland Barthes ponders the mystery of a photograph of a condemned man on the eve of his execution. And Barthes looks at that picture of a man who is no longer here, and yet in the picture is there. And he says, he is dead and he is going to die. So here perhaps is the enduring, seductive enigma of the Morris Ford reenactment, which so viscerally engages both its friends and its foes. In this uncanny spectacle, we all come to apprehend, in disturbing intimacy, those who are dead and those who are just about to die, those who murder and those who suffer, those who come back to life, and those who are forever consigned to the outer darkness. Here we are given a chance to move among the unspoken nightmare of our common history and to be suspended somewhere for an instant and for time eternal in that shadow zone that hovers between sleep, wakefulness, and our buried lives. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much, Mark. And now we have questions. It's open for questions.
My question has to do with two phrases that you used, the coming back to life, and also this waking up from a nightmare. And what strikes me for both African-American and white participants is that it seems that this reenactment may offer the opportunity to kind of enter what is already the nightmare. In other words, you're facing your very fears, and that somehow, there's this deep psychological element to this kind of inner drama. You know, if you've been traumatized, one of the effects is that you are almost compelled to reenact that trauma. And I wonder if what you think about the possibility that one of the elements in this reenactment is, in fact, a kind of reenacting of a nightmare, a personal nightmare. I'm looking at these, you know, you were talking about sort of the narrative of masculinity, both white masculinity and African-American masculinity, and that somehow getting this narrative back and changing the narrative through that reenactment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's there's a lot to that. And that is a debate that swirls around this. There are those, there are therapists really on, actually, psychotherapists and psychoanalytic figures on both sides of this debate. There's some who feel this is a classic example of the almost automatic reenactment of trauma. I mean, as Freud always emphasized, that the trauma knows no past, no present, no future. You're always there in the traumatic moment, and you're always pulled back to it. And that is certainly Pamela's claim that that everybody who does this has just been sucked back into the maw of this beast and can't move beyond it. There are others who claim, of course, it's a nightmare, but it's a nightmare we need to face up with. One of the women we see here, actually said, look, this is not just my nightmare, it's not just your nightmare. It is our nightmare. It is our American nightmare. A lot of people involved in this were enormously moved and fascinated by President Obama's speech on race. It came at a pivotal moment, of course. And the idea that everybody had to face up to this, they claimed, so that Gina actively would deny that she was a sort of passive victim. We are making an active choice to enter into this space of a nightmare, because we all have to do this as a country, as a society, as a world, in order to come out the other end. Whether or not people have found their way out is a very difficult question to answer. And it may be that both are the case. I think I'm trying to suggest that there are features of re-traumatization, but for some people there is something deeply, not just meaningful, but even healing about facing up to these hidden demons. Yes.
Hi. Has any attempt been made to recreate this performance for the actual stage or even for film in such a way that, you know, in that kind of context, it would be reproducible and it could be, you know, broadcast around the country and so forth?
That's so interesting. That actually has just happened. That's an excellent question. The great documentarian, Keith Beauchamp, has been doing a really interesting series on racial violence in America, and has just filmed, and it's just started to be broadcast around the country. He didn't come to this bridge. He found another bridge that was a little more telegenic, actually. But actually, the actors, by the way, found it very disturbing. He did use local people in some cases, and they also felt, I mean, even though it was supposed to be just a film crew and a film set, and many people felt that they were right back there. And of course, that was with much more verisimilitude. Yeah, so that will start to, and in fact, in two weeks, it's going to be screened for this community. And that's going to be really interesting what happens then. Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned it. So do you anticipate anything regarding, you know, the people who participate in this annual event actually seeing it in film, in the sense of, do you think the film would rob the people, the local participants, of the actual effect, or will there be any clash of narratives, or I don't know, what do you think?
I don't think so. I know that some of the participants have seen Rushes and so forth, and that hasn't deterred them all from a sense that they have to keep on working this thing out for themselves. And it's, I suppose, because so many of these issues are unanswerable. That's what people say. We can't really know what happened. We have to keep on trying to find it out. So that film is one way, reading is another, talking to people again and again, but each time it keeps on growing. I don't think there's a feeling, that's such an interesting question, that this could be easily exhausted. And also there's something about this, about live bodies doing this, that is so powerful, they feel, that has to be done again and again. And that's what made me really think about, makes me think about the passion play. I mean, you could have films of it, but somehow people have to gather together themselves and do this story again and again to take it into their hearts and minds.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Mark, for such an engaging talk.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a lecture by Brandeis University professor Mark Auslander titled Welcome Back to Life, Regeneration and Traumatic Memory in a Multiracial Lynching Reenactment. Tonight's lecture was presented by the Boston University College of Arts and Sciences African American Studies Program. Professor Auslander was introduced by Professor Linda Haywood, director of the African American Studies Program. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Jared Mooney and Edward Mazulis. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.